Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome now, by telephone, Benjamin Barber. He's a professor of civil society at the University of Maryland and distinguished senior fellow at Demos in New York. And he's the author of Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, published by Norton. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much. So nice to be with you this morning.
It's great to have you here. Let's talk about the concept of infantilization, which is in the title of your book. What does it mean to infantilize an adult, and how is it done in capitalist culture?
Well, in a word, it means to dumb down adults, to try to get them to behave like, spend like teenagers, kids, impulsively, imprudently, not thinking much about it, because our capitalist economy has reached a stage of so much success in providing the goods and services we need to live decent middle-class lives that capitalism nowadays needs us to buy all sorts of stuff we don't want or need. And to do that, it's got to both target kids and dumb us down to get us to be shopaholics, permanent shoppers, consumers all the time, buying an awful lot of things that were we to lay back and think about it, we'd probably say, I don't really need that. I'm not sure I even want that. I'm not even sure I know what it is, like the new iPhone, for example.
You make that, I mean, that distinction is the distinction between real needs and manufactured needs, and the manufactured needs are done through multi-billion dollar advertising and marketing industries. How do you distinguish between them? I mean, how does a citizen distinguish between a real and a manufactured need?
Well, that's a fair question, and of course, in some ways, you know, all needs, except, you know, that for water and food and a little shelter over your head and maybe sex, you know, are all needs to some degree have a manufacturer-contrived piece. But let me give a couple of examples, you know, because I think in a lot of areas it's not so subtle as that. We live in a country where you can turn on the tap and get clean, good water, rich or poor, any country, any city in this country. We have access to clean water free from the tap. Yet today there is a $20 billion a year business in bottled water. Much of that water, more than the majority, actually comes from the same sources as our tap water. You know, places like Maine and Texas and Michigan make contracts with Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola to, in effect, bottle that water. We now pay $2 a bottle. We use plastic bottles, often imported from China and other places that have a very large carbon footprint, very expensive ecologically. And we pay for that to get the same water we can have free from our tap. There's a whole hoopla about, yes, but it's this, it's that, it's good for you, it's fun, it's whatever. It's clearly a manufactured need. There is no need to drink water from a bottle when you can get a bottle and fill it up at home and carry around, yet we spend $20 billion a year doing that. There are a lot of things on that order that are so trivial, so replicative, reproductive of what's already out there, or so remote from anything that resembles a human need that I think it's not hard to say it's we got to see it as manufactured. And as you mentioned at the beginning, if they weren't manufactured, if they were real needs, we wouldn't have to spend billions and billions marketing to people to convince them that this is something they have to have.
At the same time that adults are infantilized, children are relentlessly targeted by the advertising industry. And this is something that I found actually sort of surprising and shocking about your book. It's no secret there are people whose entire careers are devoted to getting children to be consumers and establishing brand loyalties and so on. Tell us about this. What are some of the ways in which this is done?
Well, yeah, this is, and Mary, I agree with you. This to me was very scary. I remember going to a marketing conference. There are whole conferences with thousands of people in advertising and marketing devoted to targeting children, targeting teenagers, targeting tweens, and recently targeting kids as young as one year old. There's a baby first television network now that targets 6-month-old, 2-year-olds. We know all the games like Baby Einstein and so on that are around this. Supposedly make your kids smart, which every psychologist will tell you happens if moms and pops talk to their kids on a regular basis and are with them. But you know, all these things you have to now buy. So what we are seeing, again, is part of this drive to sell things to keep the economy humming long after most of us have what we need and want to actually get kids into the marketplace. So at the same time that we're dumbing down adults and trying to get them to buy impulsively, we're trying to turn kids into little shoppers. And the most frightening thing about that is that in order to do that, and this is not my language, it's the language of marketers, you have to, in their words, get rid of the gatekeepers. Who are the gatekeepers? Mom, dad, grandparents, the teacher at school, the pastor or rabbi, the people who help protect our children, the safety, the privacy, the innocence, the playfulness of our children. Marketers see the people who do that as hostile gatekeepers who have to be gotten out of the way so they can get directly out of the children. And the strategy's everywhere. Next time you go to the mall, have a look at where they place the stores that cater to teens and tweens. It's usually as far away as possible on a different level or the other end of the mall from the stores that cater to adults for clothes or furniture. And they do that in part because if you can get the kids shopping alone, if you can peel them off from their parents, they'll spend more money, they'll act more impulsively than if a family shops together. A family shopping together shops relatively prudently. If you can break them up and get mom alone, dad alone, the young teenager, boy alone, the girl alone, you can really go after them. So there are conscious marketing and even architectural strategies that are aimed at literally breaking up families. I mean, one of the things that I find so ironic here is that back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of folks who were conservative in this country, even on the right wing, used to attack big government for sort of, you know, putting moms out of the way and becoming, through the welfare state, a kind of surrogate parents. But I wish they would have the same concern when corporations push parents out of the way and become a sort of surrogate mom to sell kids crap they don't really need or want.
I find it amazing that children and teenagers have so much buying power.
Well, it is amazing, and that, again, if we want to remember, there's still a lot of inequality in America, but the fact is the majority of Americans are middle class, and the fact is there's a lot of discretionary income, and what happened, of course, is that commercial corporations discovered long ago that kids have access to the discretionary income of their parents, which is why even today you will see on television and on the Internet marketing and advertising directed at 4- and 5- and 6-year-olds. And you say, wait a minute, you know, they don't have wallets, they don't have credit cards. That's true, but they do have the capacity to go to their parents and say, I want this, I want that, I need this, I need that, and to get their parents to spend an awful lot of money on what, in fact, is marketing directly to children. So there is this extraordinary discretionary income, not just among teenagers or tweens, 10 to 12 to 13, but also kids as young as 4, 5, and 6, who thus become, you know, a powerful market magnet for people trying to sell things.
We're talking to Benjamin Barber, author of the book Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. You were talking about the conservative critique in the 60s and 70s. I think one of the ironies, and you point this out in your book, about contemporary discussions about values and politics, is that conservatives, on the one hand, reject the corruption of human values in today's world, and yet wholeheartedly support the market system that gives rise to that corruption. What's going on? Explain that.
Yeah, that's great. I'm really glad you pointed that to that for all of us, because, I mean, I think, you know, conservatives and liberals in America were always battling each other and carrying on, and I guess most people would see me as a liberal and so on. But, in fact, I really appreciate that over the years, American conservatives have fought on behalf of traditional values, the value of the family, the value of home, the value of a religious education, and so on. Those are valuable and important things, and it's certainly true that sometimes liberals forget about as they argue on behalf of the welfare state or a big intrusive government, they forget that sometimes the things we most care about in our families go astray there. But the fact is, nowadays, the greatest threat to those family values is coming from the commercial corporations, the media corporations that run Hollywood and radio and television, and the Internet, the commercial corporations that are selling all of these goods and trying to get at our kids. And I wish, you know, there'd be some of that same same anger, same resentment, same frustration, same willingness to fight against the companies that are turning our kids into targets as there was, you know, when it was the government that was doing that. And I think a consistent approach really requires that we say if we want to defend our children against the intrusions of a big bureaucratic or even totalitarian state, we also need to defend our children against the intrusions of commercial companies who, you know, one analogy I use that is a little maybe overwrought, but I think makes the point is that in we always worry today about theocratic societies, a society in which religion permeates every aspect of life. And that's all there is. Everything is about religion. Politics is about religion. Growing up and education are about religion. Everything is about religion. And while religion is important, we don't want a theocracy in which it dominates everything. Yet in the United States today, and in much of the Western world, commerce and consumerism and advertising dominate everything in the same way that in theocratic societies religion does. If you translated every single commercial sign we see when we get up in the morning to when we go to bed at night, the all those advertisements, if you put a theocratic logo that said worship Jesus or be Hindu or become a Buddhist, you know, we would all complain this was a dangerous intrusion of an overweening religion into our private lives. But commerce and advertising and the pushing of goods, in fact, does just that on television, on radio, in airports, on airplanes. I mean, you can't get away from advertising and buying and selling wherever you go in our society. And I find that intrusive and kind of totalizing in very much the same way that a theocracy, when it's religion, religion, religion all the time and nothing else and no room for anything else, is. And I think, you know, that's one of the more disturbing features of our modern society.
I never thought that I would think that I would say I grew up in the dark ages or the olden days, but I'll tell you, having grown up without a TV very much of the time and having the internet didn't even exist when I was a little kid, it was a very, very different life, and it's almost hard to imagine how little, you know, children and teenagers are living right now, and where that time that you might call downtime or boring time or times where you, you know, play with puzzles or just go outside and play with your friends, where that's gone. Is that gone?
Well, that's you know, you and I are the same in that I also grew up in the pre-television and certainly the pre-computer age. And one of the sad things about this society that is targeting children to become little consumers is that in the name of serving children and their needs and wants, it's in fact kind of destroying the variety, the spontaneity, the playfulness, the innocence of childhood. You know, there's a sort of notion today that if you don't buy it, if you don't pay for something, it can't make you happy. The notion that the only things that make you happy are the things you pay for. Whereas when I go back to my childhood, and you were talking about yours, and I think a lot of your listeners who are maybe over 40 or 50 will feel the same way. You go back to your childhood, and the things that made you happy were free. You know, a stick and a string in a pond, taking a walk, playing with your friends in the neighborhood, biking up and down the sidewalks and so on. Nowadays, half the suburbs don't even have sidewalks, so even if you had bikes to ride, you know, so there's a notion now that to be happy, you've got to buy things, you have to be a consumer and buy into all these video games and so on. And it both pacifies and makes for a more complacent and inactive childhood, but it also takes a lot of the spontaneity and the fun out of childhood in the name of actually selling kids their childhoods.
We're talking to Benjamin Barber. Let's say that everyone in this country evaluated what they really needed and didn't need for a year. They let go of everything they didn't need. They walked in the park instead of the mall. They rode their bikes. They, you know, played games instead of getting DVDs. They wore the clothes they already had. They went to political meetings instead of going to restaurants. The consumer economy would fall apart. There would be mass unemployment. What does that mean? And does that mean we're condemned to participate in consumerism for our own survival?
Well, that's exactly the conundrum and the puzzle that I try to address in the book, because you're right. I mean, what I do, I don't have conspirators here or greedy businessmen trying to take advantage of our children. What I am saying is that capitalism has been so successful, at least with the middle class and with that majority of Americans and Westerners who have a lot of the things they need, in providing us with homes and refrigerators and kitchens and cars and so on, that it doesn't have a lot of things that we really desperately need to sell us, and therefore to stay afloat, as you say, and to keep capitalism humming and so on, feels that it's got to target kids, dumb down adults, and do all this stuff. Is there an alternative, you know, that makes sense commercially? And my answer is there is, because the fact is capitalism historically prospered and helped America and the West prosper by addressing real needs. I mean, the original capitalist formula was quite remarkable because it said if you can provide real goods and real services that people really need, you can create productivity and prosperity and help people and at the same time make some money yourself. It yoked together altruism and self-interest. You know, helping others get what they need can also make you prosper and make the society prosper. So the formula is a good one. The question is, are there any more real needs? And, of course, we don't have to look beyond New Orleans or the inner city in the United States or around the third world to know there are extensive real human needs that haven't begun to be met. So here's the question. Why doesn't capitalism go back to addressing real needs that are there, say for inexpensive flood-proof housing in New Orleans, say for clean water in the third world? Here we are selling billions of dollars in water we don't need in the United States, whereas in much of the third world, people don't have access to clean water, and there is a need for ingenious inventions and for things that help people tap or clean the water in the neighborhoods where they don't have it. In other words, I suggest as a solution to this puzzle that capitalism begin to find ways to address real human needs again. And by the way, there's some people who have already made quite a lot of money. There's a remarkable little invention that a Danish company came up with, a straw, a big, thick straw that has 9 filters built into it that lasts for a year and a half that any third world person can take and drink the filthiest water, and it cleans it. And it suddenly, through one little item, allows individuals and families to have access to clean water in the dirtiest places through this little filter. It costs about $3 to manufacture. You sell it for $3.50, and you make yourself a very handsome profit. This little Danish firm is doing very nicely, but it's addressing a real need, helping third world societies prosper. There's all sorts of problems we know in New Orleans, which hasn't been properly rebuilt and so on, that capitalism could address. So, you know, the answer is capitalism needs to get back to addressing real human needs in ways that help people out of their problems, help people back into the kind of prosperity we enjoy, and at the same time allow capitalist enterprises to make a profit.
We're talking to Benjamin Barber. I do wonder, as I listened to you and as I was reading your book, whether there isn't a little bit of rosy-colored glasses going on with early capitalism, which, of course, brought us slavery, child labor, robber barons, genocide of Native Americans, and, you know, continual environmental devastation. I mean, you know, I find it hard to believe that early capitalism was somehow any more or less altruistic than contemporary capitalism.
Well, two things. Of course, you're right to say that like all human institutions, whether they're socialist or capitalist, there's plenty of faults and defects to be found. And there's no question that in the early days of capitalism, there were deep inequalities. And, you know, a lot of people weren't well served. And as you say, the young people, as young as 8 or 9 years old, were being forced into work the way they are now in parts of the capitalist world that are not regulated by child labor laws and so on. So there are plenty of issues. But you know, and you could write a book about that, and a lot of people have. I'm trying to do the other side. I'm trying to say, yes, but what did capitalism do successfully? And what it did successfully was to take this formula of responding to human needs with real things, and it did, frankly, over a long period of time, create relatively prosperous and productive societies. And we live in a world today where actually, like it or not, there's no real alternative. I mean, the socialist and command economy systems, the totalitarian and fascist economy systems, the communist and Bolshevik systems, they've all, you know, for reasons that have to do with the defects of their systems, fallen by the wayside. So to some degree, our challenge is to make capitalism work despite the inequalities. Now, there's some things capitalism does badly. It doesn't distribute wealth very well, but it produces wealth very well. It's not very good at producing jobs, but it can produce goods that are really needed and wanted through the market mechanism. And so what I'm saying is let's find ways to put the parts of capitalism that are effective and efficient, since in any case that's the only system we've got today, and make it work for us again. Will there still be inequalities? Will there still be other issues that have to be addressed? Of course they will. But what we have today is a capitalism that even in its own terms is malfunctioning. Even in its own terms is not even doing those things it does well. We know it's going to do a lot of things badly. But the things it does well, it's no longer doing well because of consumerism, because of commercialism, because of the attempt to sell all these things we don't really need or want in place of addressing real needs.
You write in your book, by the end of the 19th century, both the Europeans and the Americans came to understand that government's role was to secure the conditions that capitalism needed to flourish, but which left to its own devices, it inevitably tended to erode. Tell us more about that contradiction and how it works. Capitalism eroding the very conditions that it needs in order to flourish.
Well, and thanks, by the way, for pointing there, because you know, while part of the answer here is to get capitalism to do the things it does well, the other part is to restore the balance between capitalism and government. Because when you said quite rightly that early capitalism had a lot of problems and evils and so on that it perpetrated along with the good things that it did, by the late 19th century, it became clear to most people in capitalist countries that to do well, capitalism needed to be regulated, overseen, guided by democratic political institutions. And that was not because government did things well that capitalism didn't, but that capitalism gets into trouble when left alone. The obvious thing is capitalism is a system based on competition and entrepreneurship. But the reality was, we know from the Gilded Age, that instead of real competition, early capitalism tends to create cartels, monopolies. People like Standard Oil Company and John Rockefeller, and these powerful titans who pretend to be interested in competition but actually eat up the competition. And it was government intervention under a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, and then later Wilson and the other Roosevelt, who created a system in which, in effect, government helped enforce real competition on capitalism. Because while capitalism is devoted to competition in theory, it often creates monopoly. We saw that in the 90s with Bill Gates and Microsoft forcing a lot of the other software manufacturers out of business by unfair bundling practices and so on. And there again, the government stepped in, brought a suit against them and said, there's got to be more competition here. The litany of people who are pure capitalists, of neoliberals, is get the government out, deregulate, and you'll get competition. But we know that when you deregulated the airlines and deregulated the communications media, you get more monopoly, not less. So government has been the instrument, democratic institutions have been the instruments by which we have, in effect, helped capitalism actually maintain its competitive and entrepreneurial spirit. It's also the way in which you provide a safety net for people, because the trouble with capitalism is it's a kind of Darwinian system, win all, lose all. You know, they're winners and losers, and the losers, of course, capitalism says, gee, too bad. We can't, in a fair society, afford to say whole classes of people can be lost, and that's just too bad. So democratic government has also provided social security and medical and other safety nets that assure that people who don't do terribly well in the capitalist system are preserved in the minimum life standards they need to survive. So there are a lot of things that government can do together. And what's happened in the last 30 years, since really Reagan, Thatcher, is that, you know, we've pushed government away and say the marketplace can do it all, can do it alone, and destroyed that balance, destroyed the capacity of our political institutions to balance out and work together with our market institutions to create a fair society.
I think it's also important and interesting to note in that comment that government's role was to secure the conditions that capitalism needs to flourish. What's missing from that is its government is there to protect the people from the ravages of capitalism. That doesn't seem to be government's number one priority.
No, that's exactly right. And again, I'm trying, you know, I mean, I'm an old lefty, and I can talk, you know, and walk the anti capitalist sort of talk, but what I'm trying, knowing that today we live in a world where markets dominate, I'm trying to use a language that says, yes, of course, government has to protect us from the predatory character of capitalism, the exploitative, the unfair side of capitalism that today in Mexico is putting 10-year-old girls to work in factories, and as in the 19th century happened in London and Germany and Paris. But the other side is it doesn't just protect us against capitalism, it helps capitalism function efficiently in the areas where capitalism is, you know, a virtue and not a vice. The market society is supposed to be a competitive society, yet so often, beyond the oversight of government, it becomes less than competitive, and government turns out actually to preserve the real competitive nature. So yes, government can protect us against the predatory aspects of capitalism, but it can also help make capitalism work effectively, which is why you'll find a lot of businessmen who will say, look, you know, we appreciate the role of government in helping, you know, maintain a competitive atmosphere and helping to prevent monopolies from occurring, from providing some social safety nets for our workers and so forth, that we can't do very well. I mean, we've seen right now that big companies are saying we can't handle the medical benefits for our people anymore. You know,
we're watching
medical benefits go down, which is why a lot of us feel that in the end, government, through a single-payer system, has to have a national health scheme that protects all workers everywhere, whether they're in this company, that company, employed or unemployed, old or young. The government is the only entity that really represents the common good, the public good, and has to take responsibility for it. And nowadays, there are an awful lot of people in business who say, you know, God bless you, go ahead and do it, because we can't do it.
And yet there's a movement toward privatization, which has been going on for several decades, which you write in detail about. And, you know, the problem with privatization includes not only infantilization, but the erosion of public life. Tell us about the ideology of privatization. What areas of life does it play out in, and how does it affect participation in civic activities, in public civic life? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, in a word, of course, privatization is the ideology which has pushed for the elimination of not just government, but civil society and public goods from our life. And the ideology that says the market can do it all, you know, one-on-one competition, bilateral exchanges are all you need. You don't need government. And that has led, as we know, to the privatization of schools, of prisons, of transportation, and recently even of that sovereign state function, the military. You know, and more now we see private mercenaries and the privatization. It's not just the stuff with the companies like Halliburton and so on in Iraq and Afghanistan, but here in the United States, perimeter security on many, many American bases is handled by private security firms. I mean, the Army is hiring guards to patrol their premises. Like, what? Excuse me? You know, the armed forces have to do that? That's about this kind of out-of-control privatization that comes out of the ideology that government can't do anything and the market can do everything, and it's simply a mistake. And as you say, it also erodes and corrupts our civic and public life, the sense that we have of one another, not just as competitive producers and rival consumers, but as cooperative neighbors, as members of civil society who can cooperate and do things together and create a neighborhood and create a nation and create even a world community through working together with one another. And that quality of civic life and public life, and that sense that we are public persons who have an interest in creating a environment in which everyone can live, that has been dangerously eroded by this, over the last 30 years, this tendency toward privatization. My own view, by the way, is, Mary, that we are now at a changing point where Americans are beginning to say, enough already, there is some role for government, there is some role for democracy, there's a role for citizens and not just consumers, and I think some of the political changes we're seeing now reflect the fact that we've had enough and we're living with 30 years worth of privatization, but we may now be finally headed back in the other direction.
We're talking to Benjamin Barber. I think one important point that you make in relation to that is that, as you say, we tend to socialize the costs but privatize the benefits of a supposedly private market economy, and people are getting wise to that.
No, exactly. I mean, that's another place where the formula of capitalism has been kind of twisted, because the old formula for capitalism is you take the risks, you may go bankrupt, you may lose everything, but if you make a wise and prudent investment that meets real needs, you can make real money, and then you get the profits. But nowadays, it's almost impossible for a big company to go bust and make mistakes without being bailed out by who? By government. By us, the taxpayer. I mean, the latest example of this is the subprime mortgage industry, which has made a horrendous mess of things and has lured a lot of, unfortunately, not very wise Americans into buying homes they can't afford, you know, at a low rate for a year or two, and then suddenly the rate doubles and they lose their homes. But the fact is now government is saying to the mortgage industry, don't worry, we'll bail you out because we can't afford to have a bunch of mortgage banks go under. So here we have exactly the opposite of the old capitalist formula, because now what happens is that they get the profit, but we, the citizens and taxpayers, end up paying the cost. So in effect, you privatize profit but socialize risk. We're supposed to be against socialism, but when it comes to the socialization of risk, government and the taxpayer paying for the companies that don't make it, instead of letting them pay the terrible price of bankruptcy and going under and having their shareholders pay the risk, we, the taxpayers, do it. That's a really messed up view of how capitalism is supposed to work.
And that's not new. Didn't we do that in the 80s with Chrysler?
We sure did. No, it's been on. You're right. It's been going on and on. No, it's since the war, really. The position has been big companies are too important to the economy to be allowed to go under, which is, in effect, given a free pass to the management and shareholders of their companies, no matter how much they screw up, and no matter how badly they work, and no matter how they mess up in taking risks, they can be sure that they will be bailed out. Now, the people, say, at Enron, whose pensions were lost after a lifetime of work, they're not protected. But the companies themselves do end up getting protected by this screwed-up system. And you know, there was a politician once who ran for government back in the 70s who said, let's give capitalism what it needs, a good dose of capitalism. You know, right. If you want to take risks, bad risks, you and your shareholders have to be ready to pay the consequences of going under. But our system today doesn't really do that. And, of course, the rationale is the public interest, the good of all Americans, depends on keeping these big corporations afloat, because a corporation as big and influential as Chrysler or Microsoft or even Enron or the mortgage industry can't go under without threatening the whole economy. So all of a sudden, there's an appeal to public interest. But the appeal to public and common interest comes when you're saving the behinds of these private companies that have screwed up. How about we talk about the public interest with respect to overseeing the economy, with respect to a fair health system and fair health care, with respect to protecting individuals from the depredations of some aspects of a marketplace run wild, rather than waiting until all the damage is done and then being asked as a public interest to pick up the pieces?
We're talking to Benjamin Barber, author of the book Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. So we have corrupted children, infantilized adults, the erosion of civic participation. What are the uncorrupted values you'd like to see in the civic institutions that you think should be strengthened?
Well, there's some simple old-fashioned terms. You know, we talk in America a lot about individualism. That's a nice thing, and about private liberty. But we also have always seen ourselves as a cooperative society, as a society of communities. And I would like to see us pay a little more attention to what some people call the communitarian side, the neighborhood side, our responsibilities to one another as citizens, not just our competitive nature as capitalist producers or maybe as rival consumers. We need to see ourselves as citizens as well as consumers and producers. And to do that, we need to begin to think about what it means not just to vote in national elections. That's just one small part of it. Nowadays, we're having a hard time getting people even to do their jury service. We're getting a lot of PTA associations and local block associations have only 5 or 10% of the people who live in the school zone or the block participating. I mean, Americans increasingly don't see themselves as responsible to others, as members of a community whose flourishing depends on the participation of everyone. And I guess I'm suggesting now the kind of bankruptcy of the pure market philosophy, where the market does everything and we don't have to do anything as citizens, that's now become clear. And we Americans need to reach out and re-embrace our citizenship, re-embrace our sense of civic responsibility to one another, re-embrace our sense that we are neighbors and cooperative. See, that goes right to the top. A lot of people complained about the Bush administration. They didn't want to cooperate with allies, with adversaries, with the United Nations, with too little diplomacy, too much kind of brusque, we can do it all by ourselves. I mean, what Iraq and Afghanistan has proved is that no country, even one as powerful as the United States, can do it by itself. We, too, as a national entity, the United States needs friends and co-citizens and cooperators to get things done in the world. So, you know, from the White House down to the local PTA community, we need to understand that cooperation, neighborliness, working with others, finding common ground and shared interests is the essence of not just human survival, but human flourishing. And it's been in the background for 30 or 40 years, and it's time to come to the foreground again.
Thinking about your book, I can see how an ideology of cynicism would be easy to fall into. I mean, here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, there's a whole lot of civic participation on a local level, people going to city council meetings and really participating and engaging. But on a national level, I think a lot of people really know that the government is not of, by, and for the people, to the point that our votes aren't even properly counted. And if you're cynical, it's kind of easy to retreat into consumerist pursuits, instant gratification, you know, silly entertainment, and so on. How do you avoid cynicism?
Oh, I think that's, first of all, I think you're so right in that, and we see it particularly among young people. I mean, I teach at university. I have a daughter in high school. I'm an older parent, but I have a daughter in high school. Doesn't mean I'm so young. But when I see young people, I see a kind of two-barreled reaction. The first is, yes, I want to give, I want to participate, I want to be altruistic, I want to be a good neighbor. And then, wait a minute, the world is so screwed up that nobody cares, it doesn't matter. So fine, then I'll make money, I'll do my own stuff, you know, me and my friends will hang out and I'll find a career where I can make a killing for myself and screw the rest of it. You know, that kind of two-step dance we see. An initial impulse to really a very good, healthy impulse to want to be a good neighbor and a good citizen, and then that's what you just described, is that sort of second thing, it doesn't matter, it doesn't count, who cares, too much to overcome, so let's just be selfish, let's just be, you know, consumers, let's just get rich as best we can and have our own careers and so on. And I think there are two things you can say about this. Yes, that's a very natural reaction, but ultimately the people who suffer the consequences of cynicism are the cynical. Neither George Bush nor Hillary Clinton are going to suffer because folks in Santa Fe are cynical. The guys out there running the big corporations and targeting our children are going to be delighted if we are cynical. We pay the price of our own cynicism, which means that we have to understand that unless we are willing to get past that cynicism and begin to act, it's not going to work. But step two is, the reason we're cynical in part is not because there are predatory politicians and predatory corporate folks out there, but because too many Americans aren't carrying their own load. We are the cause of our own cynicism. I mean, you measure democracy not by the capacity of leaders, but by the capacity of citizens. And it's when citizens as a whole begin to back off and get cynical and say, forget it, that the very things we fear come true. So, in fact, it depends only on us. And in the communities, and we know we're in Santa Fe locally and places like Portland and Seattle and some New England communities where people do get involved, we know that involvement makes a difference. It makes a difference not just in outcomes, but it makes a difference in the civic spirit that people feel, the neighborliness people feel, the sense of belonging, which Americans so want to have and they've lost in these alienated times. All of those things can be garnered. So, I mean, there's no simple way to overcome cynicism other than for people to understand that in being cynics, they are their own victims and that the remedy lies in them, not in someone else. You can't wait for the right president to come along and inspire you again the way Kennedy did with some people and maybe today Obama does. We have to be the source of our own inspiration. We have to be the source of our own hope. And if we're not, we go down the drain.
We're talking to Benjamin Barber. How do you know when you have a vital civic society where adults are adults? I mean, you talk about infantilized adults. Where in this world do you see non-infantilized adults, real, genuine grown-ups?
Well, interestingly, in folks over 50 or so who have finally figured out after buying things, particularly, generation that's just now becoming 50 and 60, people who have spent 30 or 40 years trying to buy their way through material goods to happiness and have figured out somehow that's not really where it lies. And what's interesting is that you do figure out after a while that you can't buy happiness. And I think there's a whole generation out there now in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who are beginning to recognize that that's the way it is. I mean, down in Santa Fe and in the Southwest, in the Sun Belt, there are a lot of people who have spent their life struggling for material things who I think have come down that way to try to, in the latter part of their lives, find some happiness. And I think most of them, you know, are people who understand that they're not going to buy that, that the happiness they will enjoy has to do with a mate, the family they have, the sense of fulfillment in their artistic or cultural or play or recreational lives and so on, and that that has very little to do with buying things. And this notion that somehow, you know, you can buy your way to happiness, which is as American as apple pie, is what I think, you know, people who are experienced with trying to do that come to understand. The trick, though, is how do we teach that to the coming generation between 15 and 40? We're going to run the country, who are the target consumers. We know that, you know, all the movies are being made and the internet games are being made for kids between 15 and 30. How do we get that generation to get it? But even there, I see hope. There's a lot of, if you look at the alt, the A-L-T dot org generation, there are a lot of young people looking for alternative music, alternative lifestyles that don't just involve buying things and being subordinate to the commercial culture. And I think in a lot of young people, and I've seen that a lot, you see this quest for something other than just a life based on material goods. So the need is there, the yearning is there, the awareness is there in older people, and the yearning for an alternative kind of life is there in younger people. But we do need to be reassured, and that's partly what I try to do in the book, that there is a way and a rationale behind this and good reason to do this. And to do this, you don't have to make war on the market or make war on capitalism, because that's a war we're going to lose, but rather you can try to make them work right. You don't have to have big government do everything in the market nothing, or markets do everything in the government nothing. We can create a balance between the two. And what's been lost in the last 30 years is that healthy balance that we had in the 1930s and the 1960s. Between government and the marketplace, between the community and the individual. They stand in healthy tension with one another, and that's what we need to re-achieve. So, my own feeling is that, you know, though I, some ways I know it's a rather desperate diagnosis and a rather depressing one, I do see a lot of signs, both in older Americans and in younger ones, too, that we are ready for alternatives, ready for a change, and I think probably next year in the elections, but not just there, because this isn't about Democrats versus Republicans. It's about people who want to enjoy a pluralistic and full life that's not just material, some of whom are very conservative, some of whom are liberal, and those who think the market can provide all our needs.
You write about corporate citizenship and civic consumerism. What do you mean by each one?
Well, there what I'm suggesting, and this is part of the solution, that even in the corporate world, there are a lot of corporate managers who understand that corporations and companies have some civic role to play. So whether it's Ben and Jerry's or Starbucks or other organizations that are trying to figure out how to contribute to the third world, who are trying to figure out how to take part of their profits and put them into the civic sphere, you see a movement even in business to have a more corporately responsible business community, the greening of business. I mean, there are a lot of businesses now that are beginning to think, partly for public relations purposes, but partly because they know they have to live in the world they're creating, create a greener world, use less electricity, have a lower carbon footprint. The local, there's a wonderful movement afoot in America to get your agricultural goods and your groceries locally, because that saves the carbon footprint of shipping stuff all over the country, because the stuff is fresher, because it enhances and encourages local farmers and so forth, you know, there are a lot of healthy business folks who are saying, how can we create a more civic-minded, a more green, a more ecologically sound way of doing business? And that's the kind of corporate responsibility movement that is very important. It can't do it by itself. We still need our government to help, but it makes a real difference. Civic consumerism is the other side of that. The fact that as consumers, we can refuse to buy goods that have a large carbon imprint. We can refuse to buy from companies that exploit child labor. 7 or 8 years ago, a bunch of students at Duke and Rutgers and a few other universities got together and said, let's not buy athletic apparel for our football teams and for the insignia logos that go around in the stores in America from foreign countries that make those goods with child labor. And that actually went a long ways towards ending the practice in third world countries of using child labor to make athletic shoes and T-shirts and so forth with the Duke or Rutgers logo. That was done through students organizing together and making a difference. That's a sort of civic consumerism, using our consumer capacity to buy or not buy to put pressure on manufacturers to do things that are ecologically sound, that don't exploit children, that have proper safety standards and so forth. And that can be very powerful, too. So we can use our power as consumers in a kind of civic and citizenly manner. So those are two aspects, even on the market side, that allow us to influence the kind of society we live in. And if you put that together with a healthy presence of democratic oversight and democratic institutions, then you can end up with a fair balance that's going to create a much, better America and better society for all of us.
I think it's worth noting that in order for that kind of civic consumerism to operate, you really need a responsible and informative media, and one that is willing to report on the kind of abuses that you're talking about, even if those are the advertisers in that media. And that's a problem that we face.
That's the biggest problem. I quite agree with you. I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because the fact is we all depend for taking intelligent, cooperative, civic positions on information, and information is in the hands of the media. But the media is not in the hands of what in the 18th century Burke called the Fourth Estate, a group of wise people who were interested in informing the democratic process. It's in the hands of the very private conglomerates who are interested not in citizenship or information, but in profit. And that means, whether it's on cable news television of one kind or another, on the blogs or on the internet, it means there's an awful lot of intentional misinformation, withholding of information that makes it very hard for Americans to get the kind of information they need to even think wisely about this. I mean, I'm sure you have listeners out there saying, I don't agree with this guy, Barbara, but you're giving people at least a chance to hear what the argument is and to agree or disagree or do more research. And, of course, your show and others like it are exemplars in a free society of what happens if you have a diversity of media, and there is a place where these voices can be heard. But we know the dominant media voices are not particularly open, are not very broad, don't really give a chance for all the voices to be heard, and therefore the media, which should be part of the solution, providing information, insight, a platform for argument, instead become part of the problem.
We're getting toward the end of our time together. You suggest in your book that if we don't do these things, a more appropriate regulation of markets, civic consumerism, corporate citizenship, and so on, the system really has the potential to destroy itself. By what mechanism would that happen? What would that destruction look like?
Well, I think we just saw a very nice small exemplar of what can happen in the subprime mortgage crisis. It started out with a few greedy banks talking Americans who can't afford their own homes into buying homes for a very cheap rate that after a year or two doubled or tripled and forced them to have foreclosure on their homes and lose their homes. Well, on the one hand, that was terrible for the poor people who got exploited. But what we've seen is the boomerang effect, the ripple effect. We've seen now that the subprime mortgage industry has affected the good standing and credibility of the banking and credit industry generally, and we've seen that that has gone to the stability of the stock market that has been volatile and wild, and that's gone to the nature of the national economy. So when capitalism screws up in what might seem to be limited areas, it ends up creating, in this world of interdependence where everything affects everything else, it creates waves that inundate us. So the fact is, we need a capitalism that works properly and works in a healthy way, or capitalism doesn't just screw up our values and our cultural values and our civic values. It ends up screwing up capitalism. It screws up the market. It screws up the stock market. It screws up America's economic standing and therefore its world leadership. So these things have consequences. And if we don't get it right, if we don't get that balance between a healthy marketplace and a healthy democracy right, and we simply let the market wander around wherever it takes us, we are likely to be led into a disaster that doesn't just destroy democracy and our civic life, but destroys capitalism as well.
Benjamin Barber, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, and thank you for, you know, providing a place for voices to get at least this argument going in public. It's just great to be with you.
Benjamin Barber is author of the book Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole, and he is a professor of civil society at the University of Maryland. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.